This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday the 7th of August on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on this week's show, we hotfoot it to the Philippines to find out why German outdoor furniture manufacturer Dedon has set up base there.
The Filipinos and the Filipino spirit, it's most probably 99% of the reason why we're here today.
Over in Istanbul, we meet the Collection Club, a group of 100 men and women who collect just about everything.
First of all, you cannot enforce someone to become a collector. It should come from your inner feelings. It is maybe encoded in your genetics.
And in New York, we visit the office of architect Morris Adjmi to hear the story behind his most treasured possessions.
Almost any time I talk to somebody about what I do, inevitably we end up at a point, well, who's your favorite architect or what's your favorite building? And I mean, I love the city and I love the anonymous buildings. And so I think that that's where I draw most of my influence from.
All that plus we tour an enterprising regeneration project in London's East End. We talk progress and prospects ahead of Copenhagen Fashion Week. And Monocle's Richard Spencer Powell shares his thoughts on the hits and misses of the Olympic Games branding. That's all to come in the next hour on this week's episode of Section D. You might have invested in some new outdoor furniture for your garden or balcony this summer. And if you'd asked me for advice, I'd have pointed you to German outdoor furniture manufacturer Dedon. The company launched in the 1980s near Hamburg and has since captured the hearts and terraces of the global market. Our Hong Kong bureau chief, Liv Lewichnik, visited Dedon at their manufacturing base in the Philippines to find out what they're doing on the other side of the world from their German homes.
Though it may sound like it, we're not at a gathering of evangelists. We're at the morning exercise meeting of employees who work for Dedon, the German outdoor furniture maker. It's 7:45 a.m. and 300 people stand in neat rows on the company basketball court, waving arms and lifting legs in rhythm with the singing and guitar playing on the loading and offloading area, which serves as a stage. It's not your usual start to the factory workday, but then Dedon does things a bit differently. Dedon CEO, Irv Lamper.
From the beginning, everything has been about the energy, having the vision, and striving for that vision. So all along the years, in the past 22 years, from the time the company was created, the vision was to do beautiful things with family and friends. And all along, we've been working to achieve that vision together. And you have to be true to that vision. You have to be living and sharing the same values with the people around you, with your friends, with your family, with the people working with you. And this is what you've been trying to achieve.
12 years ago, Dedon's founder, former goalkeeper for Bayern Munich soccer club, Bobby Dexayer, sent the then 23-year-old Lamper on a one-way ticket to Cebu, the Philippines, to set up the company's manufacturing base. Cebu was a natural choice. It's a place with a long history of craft and weaving.
The Filipinos and the Filipino spirit, it's most probably 99% of the reason why we're here today. The other reason, of course, is because the handicraft, the skills that they have to make the best furniture in the world is really here in Cebu. And today we're very proud because we have most probably the best weavers in the world. And you want to make sure that this craftsmanship can continue. We want to build up a legacy for this craftsmanship. Very often, the weavers are the lowest part of the society. Especially in the community here in the Philippines. So we're trying to elevate the spirit, we're trying to elevate the recognition that they receive, and it's working very well. But globally speaking, yes, we are in the Philippines because we love the people, we love the family spirit, we love the warmth, the friendliness, and the hospitality, and that's why Cebu is kind of like our second home already.
The Don Cebu facility has come a long way since Lampera started with just a handful of people putting together furniture in a former pig breeding shack. Today, the factory, which has grown to a 3-hectare building, works at full steam. Here, employees bend steel into chair and table frames. They weave the best-selling nest dress, which is shaped like a giant water drop, and designs by Philip Stark and Jean-Marie Massot, as well as entire catalogues of furniture. The comfy pieces, which are destined for homes and hotels in over 80 countries around the world, are woven in durable synthetic plastic material, a replica of rattan fiber.
I think the key DNA of our products are basically four. First is quality, second is comfort, third is design, and the last, not the least, is a little bit what you called the new luxury, which is somehow a product is not just about the look, it's also about living it. And that's very key for every product that we bring onto the market. We want to make sure that they are living product, that they are living spaces for the outdoors. We're trying to create the outdoor living room.
In addition to making furniture, the Don dedicates much of its attention to its workers and the surrounding community. The company provides interest-free loans to employees. It serves up healthy breakfasts and lunches in the staff canteen, sponsors a nearby school, and is now helping local families living on a rubbish heap turn their lives around by teaching them how to weave their own houses. Driving 45 minutes north of Cebu City, we arrive at Compostela, where Dedon has bought a verdant plot of land reserved for the 40 families who will make the move here from the rubbish heap in a few weeks. Veronica Nias is one of the family members who's moving in.
Our living there is, we depend on the garbage. Most of our families will be depend on the garbage, and then that's why we grab this opportunity to have a house here. We just grab all of the opportunities that they are giving us.
The Don hopes to inspire other companies and even the Filipino government to start up similar rehousing projects in Cebu and elsewhere in the country. The idea is to effect change that lasts and makes a difference for communities. Changing mindsets also extends to a project on anti-corruption that the Don is working on together with the Chamber of Commerce. But it's not all work, work, work for the Don. The company bought a former resort on the island of Siargao 3 years ago, reopening the property for customers, clients and management. Besides being the perfect spot for some R&R though, the Don couldn't resist the urge to open an organic farm on Siargao and is now developing a new product line using plants native to the island. For Monocle in Cebu, I'm Liv Levichnik.
From furniture to fashion, this week Copenhagen hosts the largest fashion trade fair in Northern Europe. The Copenhagen International Fashion Fair, otherwise known as CIFF or CIF, has been given an overhaul since its last outing, thanks to new director Christian Andersen. Designed to appeal to a wider international audience and to support promotion of the region's brands beyond the fair dates, Andersen is on a mission to turn Scandinavia's fashion industry into a global affair. I spoke to him last week to find out more.
CIF actually in February has its 40th season, and before that it actually started out in the 60s. And in September, when I started the job, I had an interview in July and August about the job to relaunch the fair. I thought it was really, really interesting because it's a very well-known project, but it has decreased a lot, and the attention to Scandinavia, I think, was decreasing quite a lot as well. As many exhibitors, they tend to go to fairs in Europe, and I thought it was really a shame that we have a lot of good stuff here, but not really a very strong fair. So we started to create a brand with CIF. We did a new logo with Mark Jobber, who is in London, and we worked on a newspaper called the CIF Gazette in order to show that CIF is changing dramatically.
So you've sort of given it a new life, and this is what will be sort of launched next week for the first time to the public, is that right?
Yeah, it's the first time, and it's really a huge turnaround. So we see our clients, our exhibitors, as a partner, and we see them as somebody who will co-brand their brand with CIF. And in order for them to be able to feel that it's the correct brand they should co-brand with, we needed to be much more working on the same premises as they do in fashion. So it's like an ever-changing life you have, and it's about being very sure of what you want to do. Otherwise, people don't want to buy your collection, or people don't want to be at the fair. So we try to run the fair more or less as a fashion brand. And I think the very interesting thing is that we have a lot of international brands coming to the fair, and we have especially also attracted some completely new luxury advertisers in our magazine, because they want actually to be present with their brand in Scandinavia.
I know that Copenhagen Fashion Week is the biggest in Northern Europe, but it seems to be getting much more international coverage in the last sort of couple of years. Definitely there are sort of amazing Danish fashion labels that followed closely around the world. What sort of role does SIF have in promoting this too?
We're launching a kind of a 365 degree or 365 days a partnership. It means that we don't want just to love our clients when we have to sell them a space at the fair, but we want to be an active partner on social medias and in our gazette that comes out four times a year. So they will be promoted much more actively through being a partner at this fair.
And how many brands are we talking about? How many exhibitors will there be?
We have around 1,600 brands at the fair, and that's represented about around 1,000 companies all in all. So they have around 1,600 brands all together.
Goodness me, that's a huge number. And are all of
like
them...
That's like two-thirds of... Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're all sort of young and small brands, or is it a big mixture old... traditional brands as well that suddenly want to sort of expand their business?
I mean, we have a great store with a smaller design label in Denmark called Gani, and they are at the fair for the first time, and they will have a show, and they are being promoted on the social medias by the Lux Chronicles, who's working with us out of Paris on Twitter, and suddenly they got a lot of extra attention. For the smaller brands, I think we could make a huge difference for the Scandinavian brands towards the rest of the world.
Christian, something else I wanted to ask you about that you picked up on there is the importance of sort of social media in telling these stories. But do you notice that there are more and more international visitors coming to Copenhagen Fashion Week, buyers, press, people to actually see and talk to the people behind the brands and sort of touch the clothes or the accessories that are being shown?
At this fair, we have around 30,000 visitors coming to the fair, and I believe we have around 30 to 40% which are from abroad. We see a lot of foreign buyers, and we have a tradition of selling producing quite uncomplicated fashion and at a very, very reasonable price level. I think that it looks that we are attracting even more people this season. We will fly in next week 250 of the most important buyers from around the world. We have a big job in showing all these buyers around to the brands that creates collections that will work around the world.
Christian, I just have one last question, which is, I know that it's Stockholm Fashion Week the week after. Is there some sort of rivalry between Stockholm and Copenhagen when it comes to Fashion Weeks?
It's not really a competition, I would say. We're not really working together, but there's some kind of mutual understanding that Copenhagen Fashion Week is this week and Stockholm is the week after. And it seems to work quite well. Being responsible for the Fashion Week in Copenhagen, for me, it's really, really important. And we have actually a special focus on Sweden for the next fair, because all the Swedish exhibitors and buyers, they're doing Copenhagen a huge favor that they are all traveling to Copenhagen. So I'm more fond about the title being Scandinavian Fashion Week instead of Copenhagen Fashion Week, because we are very dependent on that. Our dear friends from Sweden and Norway, that they actually spend their money and time to participate here.
That was Christian Andersen, the new director of the Copenhagen International Fashion Fair, which is currently taking place. Staying in Denmark for a moment, here's a track from Danish indie pop trio Jana Factory. This is Dive. Dive, middle of emotion, dive, middle of emotion, dive. That was Dive by Jana Factory. You're listening to Section D. We'll be talking Brian Eno and Monocle Body Soap in New York after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Perfect accompaniment to summer is a well-mixed cocktail, so as the season hits its stride, we handpicked a trio of bartenders from around the world to prepare for us their cocktail du jour. From Tokyo to São Paulo via Beirut, we filmed the maestros at work, headlining the Yoshida Martini, the Lychee Caipirinha, and the Aromatic Smash. Pull up a bar stool for a front row seat. Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Welcome back. In our quest to find out how people relate to the things around them, we've delved into the lives of the design industry's leading lights and asked them to talk about the things in their lives that inspire them. Up next, it's the turn of New York architect Maurice Adjmi. Adjmi earned his stripes working under Italian legendary architect Aldo Rossi in the early 1980s. And since founding his own practice in 1997, he's been one of the most active builders in New York City. Our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, dropped by his studio to hear about his favorite things.
I think I want to start with a photograph that I bought in Los Angeles in 1996 at a show at the Jan Kestner Gallery. It was entitled Rare, Unique, and Unseen, photographs by Danny Lyon. And I was working there at the time, and I went back to the gallery a number of times. I was trying to select a photograph. There were many large prints. And then there was one photograph that was actually a contact sheet of 16 photographs from a book, or a group of photographs from a book that is entitled The Destruction of Lower Manhattan. And although I liked a number of prints of just singular images, this contact print was particularly touching for me in a number of ways. First of all, it really told the whole story of this destruction. There were two very large areas of Manhattan that were destroyed, or buildings were taken down, one to make way for a ramp for the FDR, and the other which became the site for the World Trade Center. So very large areas. It was the Washington Market and very amazing loft buildings that were just dismantled to make way for these two constructions. And I think that the book and the photographs are really amazing in that they capture a period of time. And I think that time, for me, is more than just the time when these buildings were built or when they were taken down. Because as you look through the book and you look at the images of these loft spaces, to me it almost relates to a time when New York was a center of sort of the conceptual art movement. And, you know, Richard Serra or Rauschenberg or Johns were in these loft spaces, or Donald Judd. I always look at these spaces, and some of them are highly decorative with wainscoting and tin ceilings and just really spectacular views of some of the interiors as well as the exteriors of these spaces. But I also like to think of these as spaces and the inhabitants that were there and what they were doing there, beyond just whether it was just a manufacturing facility or a storage facility, just some of the art that was being produced or products that were actually being produced there. So I sort of had a real strong connection to that, to those spaces, but then also sort of this world that's caught somewhere between a classical world and a modern industrial world. And I think that's one of the things that I always look at in my own architecture and trying to relate to this. So I sort of use these images as sort of a source book, you know, or just to mine for ideas and images.
Do you think this is something which is important to you? Because I mean, a lot of the work that we know you for in New York is very kind of sensitive building around and in existing structures. How important is it for you to have a sense of history of the city, but also, I mean, these images show old buildings kind of in decay. Is that something which excites you?
Yes. I think, you know, arrested decay is an exciting sort of place to be. And I grew up in New Orleans, and I've always been fascinated by that world that's turning, you know, or changing. I was also in Italy in a town called Lecce in the south of Italy, in Puglia. And it reminded me in a very different way. It was a Baroque city, but it's completely in a state of decay. But, you know, this glory, or these glorious buildings that then are have a different patina and sensibility about, you have a different sensibility about the way they are now after they've undergone a number of years of, you know, constant wear and change. But, you know, we recently did a hotel in Williamsburg called the Wythe Hotel, and part of the project, or part of the, I think part of our aim was to really retain as much of the historic fabric as possible, but then to really create something new there. And we completely shaved the side of the building off and created this, you know, giant factory window that faced Manhattan. So you have these amazing views, and the relationship between that window, or that big wall, and the individual windows and the punched openings in the brick, we tried to make a strong connection there, but also to create something that transcended what was there but didn't destroy it at the same time. You know, being an architect, I think it's probably pretty typical that many architects choose between being architects and photographers or filmmakers, and are always looking at photography or film as a source of inspiration. And I think that Tarkovsky, the Russian filmmaker, is one of my favorites. And I worked with Aldo Rossi, and we used to watch, I can't tell you how many times I watched Stalker with him in Italian, in Russian with Italian subtitles. So it's the kind of movie that you can sort of fall asleep and wake up in at any time, and it doesn't really change the experience. I think that's almost part of it, and that's sort of what's happening in the movie. And sort of one of the things that is really interesting to me about Tarkovsky's films is like sort of the presence of nature and water, and all the images are spectacular. But I think that that's something we'll talk about maybe a little bit, maybe talk about Eno's Another Green World and some of the work that we're doing now, where we're really trying to incorporate green. And we're doing a project in DC now where the idea is to mine all of the seeds on the site and try and reuse those to create a landscape that actually overtakes the building, like you see in some of these decaying sort of factories or water towers along railroad lines. So I like this idea of the green sort of overtaking it.
You mentioned the Eno album.
Yeah, we can go to Another Green World.
Okay.
I certainly like to listen to a lot of different types of music. If I had to pick one album that I could go off on an island and just listen to, I find that one particular, and I like all of Eno's work, but the four albums that sort of, before he went full ambient, of those four albums, Another Green World to me is the lushest and most sort of humanistic and worldly of those albums. But I think that, again, I sort of like this idea of places or things that are in transition. So it's clear that it's not really a traditional type of album or CD, and it's moving into this ambient world, and it sort of floats in and out of this other world, has this otherworldly quality. And so I can listen to that and pay attention to it, or I can listen to it and it's in the background, but I always feel like I can come back to that, and it's a real satisfying and peaceful place to be.
There was one more that we mentioned. There's the song.
Yep.
Am I forgetting something else?
The scent.
Of course.
I said that I wanted to talk about things that people could connect to, so people can go buy the Danny Lyon book called The Destruction of Lower Manhattan, which really documents the destruction of the area that became the World Trade Center. And, you know, anyone can buy that or get that album. And the last thing that I want to talk about is A Scent by Monocle, which is the bath soap. It's Sugi, it has a cedar-like quality, and that really, I use it every single morning to start my day, and it really transports me back to a specific time and place First time I was in Japan, staying in a ryokan in Kyoto, I was with Aldo Rossi and his son Fausto, and just the smell of that soap every morning just takes me back there. And since, I think, do that a lot, and I think everybody should run to the closest Monocle shop and, and go buy it.
I think we'll have to emphasize, we didn't pay for this plug.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's a total coincidence. So almost any time I talk to somebody about what I do, inevitably we end up at a point, well, who's your favorite architect or what's your favorite building? And I mean, I love the city and I love the anonymous buildings. And so I think that that's where I draw most of my influence from. And I think that the most important thing is to try to find a way to make that something more than just an extension of what's already there.
That was New York architect Morris Ajmi in his studio there. And from New York, we head next to Istanbul to join a gathering of diehard collectors in the city. From usual things like stamps and war memorabilia to diving suits and apple peelers, the 100-strong group of collectors is known, fittingly, as the Istanbul Collectors Club. But there's more to collecting than just hoarding and organising. Our reporter Ashley Cleek met with some members of the Istanbul Collectors Club, and here's what she found.
Mustafa Murat Yujad owns a wholesale hobby shop in Levent, a suburb of Istanbul. The shop is full of models of everything. Model ships, model warplanes, cars, dollhouse furniture.
This is an anti-aircraft gun which comes in small pieces. Maybe you can... What you do is you have to cut them, clean them, then paint them, and then assemble it, and then altogether it becomes the anti-aircraft gun like this.
It's obvious when you walk in his shop. Murat is a great collector.
I used to collect many things from my childhood. First, it started with small pictures of football players and artists, which came out of chewing gum packages, and then metal caps of soda bottles, pin badges, which is I have 2,200 pieces now. Then I started recently, about 10 years ago, a collection of single malt Scotch whiskies. A collector has got that characteristic. Then you can easily detect it by even if the most unuseful object, you think three times before you throw it away. So everything you have, you start to think if this will be something collectible. If you don't think of it like that, you cannot be a collector. You can buy a collection, you can own a collection, that's something else. But collecting yourself means you have to be very respectful to what you are, what you possess, what you own.
Murat was one of the founding members of Istanbul's Collection Club, called simply Collection Club. A group of 100 men and women who collect, well, everything.
Adım Şerif Antepli.
Şerif Antepli is the president of the Collection Club. He started the club in 2000. Istanbul, Şerif says, has all different kinds of collectors. One man collects old underwater diving suits. One collects unusual apple peelers. Anything can be collected, Şerif says. But not anyone can be a collector.
Bir kere hiç kimseye sen koleksiyoner ol diyemezsiniz.
First of all, you cannot enforce someone to become a collector. It should come from your inner feelings. It is maybe encoded in your genetics.
Like Murat, Şerif collects many things. Shot glasses, decorative spoons, hundreds of tiny miniature bottles of alcohol, all lined up on display. But stamps are Şerif's real passion.
Benim için en özel pul, çocukluğumda harçlığımla postaneden gidip aldığım puldur. O benim için en kıymetli pul.
The most precious stamp for me was the one that I bought first with my pocket money when I was a kid. I remember going to the post office and buying this stamp from there. And there was this picture of Mehmet Akif Ersoy, who is a famous poet and also the author of the national anthem of Turkey, on this image. But what makes it precious was not the picture on it, but the feeling of buying it with your own pocket money.
Şerif has made several books of photos of his stamp collection. His most prized stamps are of movie and television stars.
Envelope, stamp, Muppet, Muppet Show. And start.
He has thousands. stamps commemorating the invention of radio or television, stamps from the Ottoman Empire, stamps from countries that no longer exist.
Her pul bir ansiklopedi maddesidir.
Every stamp is like an encyclopedical source. Every stamp has its own story, tells something. You cannot simply get a stamp and put it to another place. You should research on it because it contains information. It contains knowledge.
While it sounds kind of morbid, one of the repeated worries of collectors is what will happen to their collection when they're no longer around to look after it.
Bütün koleksiyonerlerin ortak sıkıntısı budur.
Well, that's the common problem, the biggest problem of all of the collectors. What is going to happen after I die to my collection? But I am personally happy because my daughter is also interested in the stamp collection. So I will give my collection to her before I pass away.
My name is İrfan Yalın.
İrfan Yalın owns a shop on Istanbul's Asian side. The shop is stacked with masks, statues, candlesticks from Tanzania, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. A big Buddha sits next to shelves of bangles and rings. İrfan is a collector, and his store is an extension of his collections. He has binders filled with old advertisements, his favorite, an ad for a pencil sharpener from 1902. And he has old photos.
I mean, it's very old book about 100 pages, very small book.
İrfan holds a small blue photo album full of square photos, 2 centimeter by 2 centimeter, tin type photos, photos printed on tin. İrfan explains that one day a friend in England sent him a package.
He sent me one tin type photo. So I just realized when I opened the envelope, then I asked myself, what is it? So I find the huge history behind it. This tintype photo is early type photo. So I try to learn, I try to understand what is it. 150 years ago, people first time they saw themselves on the picture. So I try to learn, I try to understand what is it. Who was that lady? I mean, what was her experience? What was her life story? Many questions. When you find one answer to the 1,000 questions, I think you get very happy.
İrfan has over 1,000 tiny tin photos. He plans to exhibit them, possibly at the American Embassy in Istanbul. İrfan is the vice president at the Collectors Club. He says Istanbul, with its thousands of years of history, has influenced the way he sees the world, the way he collects.
I mean, this is amazing history. So if you live on that kind of very rich ground, so you notice very different kind of things. It affects the culture. In my opinion, Istanbul is effective city for collectors.
İrfan says he is constantly trying to encourage people to collect.
The people say, actually, I don't have time, I don't have money. But actually, in my opinion, the time in the modern life, in the city life, each person has a time problem. In my opinion, everyone needs hobby. Everyone needs recreation. This is very important. If you want to be as a happy, healthy, and in good mood, everyone needs one hobby. This is very important, really. Because hobby, it gives power, it gives energy, and also is a very nice thing to look for some things, to go for some things. Try to learn for some things. Also, I mean, if you have no idea about tomorrows, the life is, in my opinion, can be very bored. I have some collector friends. They collect specifically one subject and they go to deep about their subject. In my opinion, they are collector. I think I am a kind of rubbish collector because I collect everything. I like everything. I try to collect everything. So they call me rubbish collector. I don't know which one is good, but I do like it and I collect. Maybe one day it makes good sense to public.
For Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Ashley Gleick.
Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We're back in London next to visit the creative collective behind a new 100-metre-long mural.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology and driving.
Welcome back. For the residents of East London, the Olympics has been a boon beyond just the excitement of having the sporting events take place on their doorstep. The longer-term legacy has been agonised over, in a bid to open up East London permanently, not just fleetingly, to the rest of the city and beyond. Some of the more instantly beneficial changes have been community-driven. Bread, a new creative collective, has just finished a 100-metre-long typographic mural, which tells the story of Hackney's industrial past, together with a programme of talks, workshops and a documentary blog. Our reporter Emily Aylett visited Bread at their site to hear more.
We live in the area. We've seen the street, White Post Lane, get continually vandalised. So we thought it'd be a good idea to do a community project where we ask people's opinions what they'd like to say about Hackney Wick and paint a huge mural.
The idea was to put something in place so that maybe people wouldn't necessarily vandalise it, something that had a bit of local history or something. And once we got proposals, we had various meetings with them, and then we held a lot of community workshops because we knew the importance of getting the community involved. That formed the basis of our design, so we took a lot of words and things that people had said about the area. Kind of a lot of the older people in particular said about factories and places either they'd worked or their older relatives had worked, and all the things that were invented or made around here. So that seemed like a really interesting sort of starting point.
But it wasn't just old people from the area that you got involved, was it? You've been working with young people as well.
Yeah, we worked with the Hackney Create Centre, which is this amazing new centre that's just opened. And they do lots of like art gallery projects, and we got all the kids from the local community, and they came down and they, you know, told us what different things they love about the area, and they had a go at doing some painting and doing different kinds of patterns, and we took their ideas into like the different colours that we used. It was just really great because they all love the area and there's so much going on around here.
And the colours that you've used are really gorgeous. So you've got quite muted, colourful colours, but muted colours as well. So you've got kind of duck egg blues and pinks. And how did you choose the colours?
We got in touch with the Forest Recycling Project, and they're in Walthamstow down the road, and they have this great scheme where you can go and use their recycled paint, which is basically full pots of paint that either large businesses have left over or people have bought too much. By using this, it meant that we had the chance to actually mix the paints to get the colours we wanted.
We used a lot of the neutral colours they had. I mean, a lot of the masonry paint they had was kind of creams and whites, and then we used colour additives as well to kind of create some of the more punchy colours.
We looked at all the kind of signage from old factories around here, and a lot of it's faded over time, but you can still see the original colours, and we kind of wanted to replicate that, or at least reference it so people know that it's in keeping with the whole area rather than colours that would clash with the rest of the things here. We walked around the area quite a lot just through living here and photographed the old signage on the factories, and we tried to match up, because a lot of us are typographers, we matched up typefaces that we recognise from these signs and tried to make it look as authentic and without looking like a pastiche or anything, but just authentic of the old signage. So.
Murals can be quite controversial. How did you mentioned earlier that you did consultation with the local community and wanted everything to fit in. Did you have any opposition from local people about this?
The wall we've just painted, behind it was a massive mural painted by Coke maybe 3 months before we started painting. I think just because of the content of the mural and it being for Coke, within 24 hours it was vandalised. People splash paint on it. We were very aware of this when we started this project. We were like, we don't want this to happen to our mural. We want it to be about the community and not about this massive company.
We put up signs this is a community project, it's not for Coke, and that came quite sort of a laughing point, wasn't it? People were taking photos of that, and you know, I think once people found out what it was all about, was just everyone was really positive about it around here, and you know, when they actually took the time to talk to us, didn't they? And
yeah, that was a really big learning curve for us, that if you're going to do anything in the public, you have to inform people. You can't expect people to know what it's about, because there was a website and we'd promoted it quite heavily, but still people day to day aren't going to read the poster, so we had to put these signs up along the wall. And then since then, you know, it's been a talking point. People put the photos of the signs up on Twitter and stuff, and it was quite a good aspect of the project that we hadn't expected. So we just think that this area is full of artists, and why can't it be similar to places like Barcelona or Berlin, where in, you know, areas like artistic centres, they let people paint proper murals rather than just tagging, which a lot of these kids, that's what they want to do, proper art, and they just don't have the outlet for it. So
one other thing I'm interested to know about, when you look at the wall, the colours really are beautiful and it really does catch your eye as you walk past it. What are the significance of the words you've got written on the wall? Because there's some quite contrasting words. You've got some modern words, you've got pickles written on the wall, you've got mint creams written on the wall. What's that about?
Well, that was just coming from talking to people, you know, from that have been in the area for years, and the kind of one theme we got out from all the conversations were the things that were made in the factories. So shellac was made here, pickles were made here. Hopefully, if you're new to the area, you'll question it and make you want to find out more.
As you know, there's so much focus on what's happening now with the Olympics and what's going to happen, that we just wanted to kind of pay homage to sort of the past, really, and what has been here.
That was Emily Aylett reporting there in East London. And we're sticking with the Olympics for our next story too. After all the moaning, speculation and scrutiny of the logo, branding and outfits prior to the event's start, now that everything's been unveiled and the Games are well underway, I sat down with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell, to find out what he made of the branding hits and misses.
I'm loving the Olympics. I think it's been great so far. I think the only disappointment for me is that the first week is a lot of swimming events. And so there's a distinct lack of kit. And I've noticed this time around, maybe...
A lot of skin.
Yeah, there's a lot of skin. And but there's a lack of colour. Everyone seems to wear the same swimming costume, particularly the women. The only difference is the swimming caps, and they're pretty plain. They, you know, the Team GB wear red, and that's the only way you can recognise your athlete. And I just wondered why, because I think there's a missed opportunity. I can't imagine... Bright yellow creates more drag in a swimming pool than black. I mean, do they think it's slimming? It's slightly strange. And I think for most of us that aren't actually at the events, it's a televised sporting occasion. And so I'm sure many offices across the country have got TVs on like we have here. And you can't see, unless the volume's up, you can't see if your countryman is first, second, third, last.
No, you can't see the difference between North and South Korea when they're in swimming lanes.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly.
Swim caps is a missed opportunity as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, I think so. And I think everyone likes, you know, kit. And I can't wait for the cycling, the velodrome cycling to start, because they're just, you know, all the helmets and the bikes, the wheels, the frames, everything there. Is much more branding involved.
There's a lot to decorate. And they do take a much more advantage of that, don't they?
And it's just more exciting. It's kind of a bit more effervescent in a way. And it's strange because when you suddenly see the Brazilian football team, you can recognise them from, you know, the other side of the office. It's instantly that yellow is Brazil. But, I mean, some events, so swimming, but also equestrian, you just can't recognise them. And I think from a sort of graphic language point of view, from signage, that's... It's a slight mistake in a way.
Do you think it has something to do with the actual sports themselves? I mean, sort of cycling, football, sports that maybe are a little bit sort of cooler, dare I say, without using a very uncool
word. Well, yeah, I think there's that. I think obviously in team sports, you have to be able to pick out your player from the other side of the pitch. So they need to be brightly coloured. We can't all play in navy, even if it's, you know, quite a nice colour. But I don't quite get... I'm sure there's a reason why the swimmers have all got the same similar kind of outfits, but I don't quite get it. And I was really hoping as well that... I know the costumes are very sort of scientifically designed, that they're aquadynamic, but I was kind of thinking... I was hoping that some trashy Russian would have like a high-cut kind of Pamela Anderson-style one. And because I can't imagine, you know, hips... You know, generate a lot of drag. Well, depends whose hips they are, actually. But if you're an Olympian, you'd think they're kind of pretty narrow.
Yeah, there's a hundredth of a thousand second in showing your hip in the water or not. Rich, what else has struck you from, I mean, with now sort of know the Hull Olympic site off by heart, pretty much, having had such sort of intrigue about what it was going to contain and how all those amazing buildings that we saw were going to be connected. Do you think that the sort of branding of the Olympic site and the Olympic Village and things has been a success?
I do think it's been a success, and I think I don't particularly agree with the way the logo was chosen and the process before the Olympics, but I have learnt to love it, I think. And I think one thing about the branding of this, and I think it's a good exercise that, you know, grads out there should study, is that it's very, very distinctive. And although the logo is a bit Fred Flintstone, because it's distinctive, people have been able to adopt it and apply it to that kind of graphic language to lots and lots of things, and it makes it very, very recognisable in a way that EasyJet is recognisable. Have you ever seen an EasyJet motorbike? Probably not, but you can picture one quite clearly. It's the Cooper black font and it's bright orange, and it's bad, but it's very, very recognisable. And if you look on Oxford Street, I think it's John Lewis have kind of adorned the facade of the shop with a giant Union Jack. And it's been made up of the kind of the angular branding of the Olympic ident. And you can recognise it straight away that it's on brand with the Olympics. And so I think there's been a huge success in terms of it being recognisable.
Creating an identity.
Yeah. And in a very big, bustling city, to stand out is probably one of the hardest tasks, and I think they've really met that in a slightly garish kind of way. Yeah, so I think there's definitely some success there. I was thinking recently that, again, if you take the buildings out of the equation and you're not actually getting to go to see the Olympics because you didn't, you know, get tickets for whatever reason, or you didn't want to fly into London, essentially it's a televised event. Or if you're travelling to the Olympics, you're on Transport for London, whether you're on tubes, buses, whatever. And I did think perhaps for most people, all the branding they will see will be on London Underground or on the BBC. And I wondered whether it wasn't a good idea to actually give the branding to both of those establishments, because the BBC have got a great design team. And actually Transport for London, you wouldn't think, but actually a lot of their branding on the Underground is really good. They're quite switched on. They have an arts programme down there.
And real history as well of incredible design.
They've got a typeface, which is brilliant. It's famous. They've got the Underground symbol is a circle. It would link into the Olympic rings. I think they could have saved quite a lot of money and done something quite spectacular there. And I wonder if that's something for Rio to think about. I don't know how far on they are with their branding, but I would say get your... if they've got a decent transport design team, I'd say get them involved and get your main broadcaster, get the design team, get them going on it, because I think it sort of makes sense in a way.
That was Monocle's creative director dispensing his Olympic branding wisdom. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be having an East London making and manufacturing special. Dominic Wilcox, a London-based designer, has recorded the sounds and stories of 21 East End makers. We'll be hearing a few of them, and from him, in next week's episode. But to play you out, we're back in Turkey to hear from veteran singer-songwriter Tarkan. Here he is with Ask, from his 2001 album, Karma. Today's show was produced by Alexander Mills and edited by Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thanks for listening. Seni gördüm göreli, ateşine düştüm düşeli, gün doğdu sabahlarıma.